Perfect Killer, Chapter 6. From the shadowy perch hidden beyond the silvery weathered boards of a derelict and graffiti-smeared lakeside cottage, the shooter focused on the drama playing out in the perfect circle of the scope's eyepiece. The reddish mist from the lawyer's head appeared as a silent cloud of warm dust. That sight created the familiar calming sensation that ran warm in the shooter's veins. The shooter paused to get the first real-life glimpse of the famed Dr. Bradford Stone, legendary Marine recon operative turned healer and scientist. He was such a big man, 6'5", 230 pounds, that he filled the scope's field of view and made it hard for the shooter to resist taking him out too. Before the first shot, the shooter had canvassed his face. She'd looked into his deep green eyes and compassed the lines of his face and the arrow-straight part in his short graying hair, and knew she could have taken him out in another split second. But her employer had other plans for him. The dossier they had given her on Stone tracked him through every country in Southeast Asia and included fitness reports that described a friendly, congenial, well-mannered, ethical, a deeply moral man with an outstanding record of killing those who were enemies of his country. Stone's lengthy and highly classified record of his service, both as an active duty Marine and a government contractor afterwards, showed an unusual proficiency for killing. And he was superb. At close range with bare hands, knife, garrote, or at the farthest distances as one of the best snipers ever to graduate Camp Pendleton. The one day, he filed a request to train as the unit's medical officer. Stone's request was approved, and he became a gifted healer who could staunch a bleeding wound with one hand and kill an attacker with the other. For Stone, killing was preventive medicine. His dossier contained extensive psychological evaluations indicating that Stone still had no moral issues with killing in the service of his country or his own self-defense, but that he'd grown weary of dealing with his post-battle regrets of killing other humans. He was afraid he'd stop having those regrets and start to enjoy the process. The shooter remembered a time when she too had to struggle with the personal nature of reaching out and touching her targets, seeing their faces and regretting the deaths as a necessity of war. But that regret ended with her own wounds. Now, killing brought her profound joy. Other soldiers kill to live, but she lived to kill. Bang! The shooter whispered faintly as the crosshairs of the loophole 6x scope tracked Stone and the dead lawyer as they rolled to the ground. Then she heard the reports of small caliber weapon, a handgun from the sounds. She played the loophole around the cemetery and quickly spotted a man with a shaved head firing in her general direction. "Goodbye, motherfucker," the soldier said as she steadied her breathing and caressed the trigger like the lover it had become. Perfect Killer, Chapter 7. It was too damn cold to be Thailand or Vietnam, but in the next split second my body reacted with the old combat reflexes my brain had developed there and in a variety of other warm, humid places where I was officially not supposed to be. Slugs thumped into graves around me as I gave Vanessa a great bear hug and rolled with her into a pale protective penumbra in the lee of a polished marble monument. Slugs tracked us as I rolled, peppering my face with the sharp, stinging shrapnel of frozen earth. When the timbre of the slugs changed key and chewed at the soft stone of the marble monument, I knew we were safe, if only for a moment. I paused, then to think. To plot a path of escape, or, barring that, better shelter. I didn't want to die in a cemetery, although it did suggest a certain ironic propriety. Then a second firearm waved in from my left flank with a higher, shorter pitch. I looked over and watched Rex shooting from the safety of Mama's headstone. His return fire silenced our unknown assailant. In the brief lull, people yelled in the cell phones for help. An instant later, rapid semi-automatic weapons fire from somewhere beyond the magnolia plowed the earth around Rex in a potting soil, shredded the green canvas canopy, and ricocheted off the heavy steel of the backhoe. There was an instance of silence. This distant snick and clatter of a magazine being ejected echoed across the field. A fresh one inserted. Then came a volley coming as fast as our assailant could pull the trigger. Then an instant later, the shot ceased. I focused my thoughts and stilled my ragged breath in the calm, steady rhythms that had served my survival so well in the past. I looked over at Rex. He gave me a thumbs up and made a questioning nod toward Vanessa. I wiped at the tissue that covered my face, then examined her closely. As the medical specialist for small, agile detachments of highly mobile combat teams, I had seen wounds like her before, and I had never seen anyone survive. Regardless of that, I laid her gently on the cold earth, ignored the hideous wound, and searched all the usual locations for some sign of a pulse. Finding none, I pulled back the lid on the intact eye and found the pupil wide, flat, and totally unresponsive even when I erected a fingernail firmly across her forehead. So dilated was the pupil that I had to close my eyes. I had to close my eyes to remember the deep wisteria that had once made her gaze so compelling. I looked over at Rex and shook my head. Then from somewhere beyond the magnolia and to my ears, farther down Lakeside Drive toward town came the high-pitched whine of an electric starter, then the growl of a powerful motorcycle engine. It idled for only an instant, then accelerated swiftly into the distance. Perfect Killer, Chapter 8. As the sirens regained the upper hand over the receding motorcycle noise, Rex made his way over to me in quick, erratic lunges, using the headstones and monuments for cover in a practiced manner far too accomplished to be self-taught. One more mystery. As he crouched beside me, he tucked a palm-sized 9mm automatic into an ankle holster. "Catch you later." He looked around with a quick, precise scan as the sirens grew louder. "Can't afford to hang around." He gave me an enigmatic smile. "All those warrants, you know." Then he was gone, all swift, fluid moves and secure, confident steps. I was even more convinced than ever before that I would not want him as an adversary. With the immediate threat certainly gone, the great survival gate in my mind imploded beneath a dark flood tide of biting grief. As I looked down at Vanessa, not really her, but at the deceptively dead sack of organic remains of what had once been her, I looked for a thought, tagged this feeling with, a dust-to-dust sentiment, or maybe something about remembering people as they had lived and not as they had died. But where I'd remembered psalms and sorrow and guilt with Mama, Nietzsche came to me now. Words I had not remembered since college filled my head, and with the same dark emotional entourage that had accompanied my post-adolescent Hermann Hesse Steppenwolf phase. "Many die too soon, and a few die too late. Die at the right time. Die at the right time. Thus teaches Zarathustra." I shook my head, trying to shed the words. But it was all too clear to me Vanessa had not died at the right time, and that made me angry. I held my hand close to my face, and I looked intently at the bits of gray matter clinging there. Fractions of a second before, the tissue had held Vanessa's mind. I had devoted my life to figuring out just how this biological jelly mysteriously orchestrated itself into the phenomenon of consciousness, how it defined who we were, and how it gave us the unique human consciousness of being conscious, our awareness of being aware, of being aware. I sat back on my haunches, transfixed by tissue that had once sustained genius and goodness, a sense of humor and one of outrage. Now the shards of Vanessa's mind were just sticky, dying bits of organic dust to be, thanks to a simple transfer of kinetic energy from a few grams of lead. "Where are you?" I tried to imagine where her thoughts had gone. Suddenly sirens pulled me back into the cold, bitter day as first one, then a second squad car came flying into the cemetery, showering gravel all over the nearby graves. A big, white, boxy ambulance followed a few seconds behind. The driver's side door of an Itabena PD squad car opened, and a moment later a defensive, tackle-sized black man in a police uniform climbed out. He reached deliberately into the car and pulled from it a large black cowboy hat, which he carefully set on his head. Only then did he look slowly around the cemetery and pull a large automatic pistol from its holster and hold it along his thigh,
index finger resting ready outside the trigger guard. Shouts echoed through the cemetery. Everyone pointed at me. The cemetery grew silent again as the giant cop looked me over. His face was broad and as expansive as a cast-iron skillet as he took in my embrace of Vanessa. Something like disapproval rippled beneath his gaze, and then turned to horror as he took in Vanessa's bloody, gaping wound. I saw recognition make its way across his face. Despair, then anger. Finally, sadness played across his face in cinematically swift flashes as he recognized who she was. During all of this, the ambulance attendants stayed close to their vehicle, looking to the giant cop for directions. Finally, he holstered the automatic and made his way slowly toward me. The paramedics came running behind. The contents of their kits rattled in the stillness. I thought to tell them they could take their time, but my words found no voice.